Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight.
Hi, this is Buzz Knight, the host of the Taking a Walk podcast series, the special New York City Greenwich Village series, a very special episode with an iconic photographer of our time. He's captured everything. He's seen everything. He was part of the scene. He didn't just capture the scene. He was part of the scene. Bob Gruen, it's so nice to meet you, Bob.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you. It gets a little loud. We can go through the courtyard here.
Okay.
Probably better.
Okay. Well, Bob, it's so nice to meet you, and thank you for being part of the Taking a Walk series here in New York City. How have you been the last couple of years? It's been a little wacky.
Well, I'm a little wacky, like most people. It's been a time of anxiety and uncertainty, but most of my life has been uncertain, so I'm used to that part.
You started as a photographer, really capturing everything in your family photography, right? I mean, that's where it all began.
Well, I learned photography from my mother. It was her hobby. And my mom taught me how to develop and print my own pictures. And I just took a liking to it and started taking pictures of my family, which actually was good practice for working with rock and roll bands, since they're all like dysfunctional families. And you gotta try and get all the five or six people looking good for 1/60th of a second. So I kind of learned that with my family. After high school, I lived with a rock and roll band. The idea was to turn on, tune in, and drop out. And so I dropped out and lived with a band. But I didn't know I was actually falling into the rest of my future.
You really never held a formal job.
Not really, no. I've had a couple when I was young, but it didn't last long.
So you knew you were hooked right away.
Yeah, I wasn't really set up for the 9-to-5 kind of job because I couldn't make the 9 o'clock part. I was much more of a night person.
So, I know Tina Turner. When you first saw Tina Turner, Ike and Tina Turner, that was a transformative experience. Can you talk about that experience?
A friend of ours said we should go see Tina Turner, Ike and Tina Turner. Because they were a great band, a great show, and so we went with her, and I was absolutely blown away when I saw Tina for the first time. She was the most amazing act I'd ever seen, still is, actually. And so we came back a couple of days later, and I brought my camera to take some pictures, and at the end of her show, a strobe light flashes, and she dances off, with the multiple images flashing in front of your eyes, and I set the camera for 1 second, and I took one picture of... I had no idea if it would come out with all the different flashes, but it came out really well. And then we went to see Ike and Tina a few days later in New Jersey, and I brought the pictures with me to show my friends. And on the way out of the theater, one of my friends saw Ike Turner going from one theater to another, and she literally pushed me in front of Ike and said, "Show Ike the pictures." And he stopped and he looked at him and he said, "These are really good pictures. I got to show these to Tina." And he took me in the dressing room, and Tina liked the pictures. And pretty soon I started working with them. And that was the beginning of my career.
One thing led to another. So the clubs were just so amazing. You were hopping from one to another all through the night. All through your life. So let's talk about the clubs, first of all.
Well, back then, at first I think I started going to... Pat Kenny's club, which was called Kenny's, up on 84th Street. And
see, what's so cool about Taking a Walk, Bob, I'm sorry to interrupt, is we let the dogs bark, but we do watch in case we got to step in something. So
yeah, well, people tend to clean up after themselves nowadays. It's not like it used to be, I'll tell you that.
Sorry to interrupt.
It's okay, but anyway, I used to go up to Kenny's Castaways a lot.
Sure.
Patrick Kenny ran that, and it was a really eclectic club. He had everybody... from, who was it, Willie Dixon, to the New York Dolls, to Yoko Ono, to Tracy Nelson, to Larry Coryell, all in a little Irish bar. So it was a lot of fun to go there. And then I found out about Max's Kansas City, and then CBGB's opened around 1975, and started going there a lot. And it was just one thing after another. I mean, there's still... a lot of clubs now. There's like more clubs than ever, but they're all out in Brooklyn. And since I'm not in that young crowd of 20-year-olds, who tends to go out to clubs anymore, I don't really go out there.
So go back to Max's for a second. Mm-hmm. The back room at Max's was kind of legendary for all the sort of like the media folks to hang out and everything, right?
Well, I don't know media folks so much. It was a bunch of artists. First in the late 60s, when Mickey Ruskin was running it, it was Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein and those kind of brothers. That's where John and Yoko lived, by the way, right here on Bank Street. 105 Bank Street. When I first met John and Yoko, they lived right here.
Look at that. Wow.
It's an easy commute, half a block from my house.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing.
But and that door went right into their apartment. So after about a year, when everybody knew that John and Yoko were living here, they had to move out because it got a little too popular.
I would say, right?
But anyway, back to the clubs. It was a lot of fun back then. There wasn't any real kind of corporate interest. You know, a lot of bands were playing for fun. They were playing to get a drink and meet a girl. You weren't really expecting to make your career coming from a dumpy little club, you know. But it turned out that worked out okay. A lot of people started at some really good careers.
And at Max's, I remember seeing Patti Smith do poetry there.
Uh-huh.
What's your first memory of seeing Patti Smith?
I saw her at Max's, and it was kind of a cross. She was like reciting poems but with a music background. First time I saw her, Lenny Kay and R.D. Soul were already playing with her. So, very much like rock and roll, but with a beat.
So when you were going out to the clubs, you were driving some pretty badass cars in those days, weren't you?
Well, I always liked to have nice cars. Actually, back in the early days, I don't know, I had a Volkswagen for a while in the early 70s. And then, actually, the best car was in 76. My brother found me a car for $300. Somebody was trying to get rid of it. It was a 25-year-old car. It was a 1954 Buick with only 25,000 miles on it. It was amazing, perfect condition, old classic rock and roll 50s car. And I drove that for about 5 years till I crashed it.
But I know some of the artists that you were hanging around with, if they would pull up, you know, they were playing a gig or something, and they saw that Bob was in the house, they felt really comfortable because they saw your car.
Yeah,
there,
Debbie,
right?
Debbie Harry mentioned that. She was giving me an award one time, and she said that she came up to CB's and she saw my car. She knew it was an okay night. She hadn't made a mistake and come on the wrong night.
You were a reassuring figure.
That if I was there, then something good was going to be happening. I thought that was really nice of her.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So do you remember the first time meeting John?
The first time I met John Lennon?
Yeah.
The first time I saw John and Yoko was at the Apollo Theater. We'd all read that they came to New York. They were seen riding bicycles around the village. I mean, everybody wanted to meet John and Yoko, but you don't really go to their door and hang out, you know, at least I don't. But then I went to the Apollo Theater for a benefit concert to benefit the prisoners' families, the prisoners who rioted at the Attica prison. And much to my surprise, John and Yoko were there. I took a couple of pictures when they were on stage, and then they were waiting for their car backstage, and a bunch of people were taking pictures, snapshots, you know, like selfies we call them now. And John at one point said, "People are always taking our picture and we never see it. What happens with these pictures?" And I said, "Well, I live around the corner from you. I'll show you my pictures." And he said, "You live around the corner?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, slip them under the door then." And I thought that was very neighborly, you know. And that was our first conversation, if you call that a conversation. But I went by the house, and I didn't quite slip them under the door. I rang the bell. Much to my surprise, Jerry Rubin answered the door. I didn't know he did that sort of thing. But he asked if they were expecting me, and I said no, and I just left the pictures. And later, when we did get to be friends, Yoko mentioned that they were very aware of that. Like, who was that who didn't want to meet us, who just dropped something off, you know? And I think they liked the pictures. So it was a few months later when I was included in the first book of rock and roll photography, called The Photography of Rock. And yeah, we can cross over here. It's probably quieter up at a river. So I got an assignment to take pictures of them, and I went to the hotel to take pictures, and I remember the reporter saying they weren't ready for, you know, they weren't expecting me, but they would feel better, and anyway, they eventually let me come up to take pictures, and as I was walking down the hall, I remember feeling really nervous, like shaking. I was going to meet John and Yoko, I couldn't believe it, but I knew I couldn't take pictures shaking like that, so I actually stopped in the hall, I took a deep breath, and I kind of said to myself that everything would be all right, because it was all right. It could be better, but it didn't have to be. And it would only work if I just calmed down, relaxed, and did what I did, and they happened to like what I do.
And so you became their personal photographer?
Over time, yeah. I mean, as they got to know me better, and I got to know them better, that I started working with them a lot more. And you build up a trust over time. So that's what we did, and we got to know each other better and better, and I'm still in touch with Yoko today. Now it's 50 years later.
And how is Yoko?
I met them in the spring of 1972.
Wow.
So it's been a while. Yoko's okay. She's doing well, you know, like everybody. She's hiding out from the COVID and the lockdown.
But she's still artistically curious.
Always. Always. Yoko's an incredible inspiration. It's interesting because John said, in one of her books, Yoko said, or in an interview, John said that she's the most famous unknown artist. Everybody knows what Yoko is, and nobody knows what she does. And that's kind of a fact, because although she has museum exhibits and art exhibits around the world all the time, and more people are finding out what she does, the majority of people found out more about her than her art. Her art was always, they made fun of it because people didn't understand it. But if you actually look at her art and start to learn about it, her art is fascinating because it's very simple. On the one hand, it's conceptual. In other words, a lot of her art is just a sentence. But it's a sentence that makes you think and feel. And people don't like to feel. And they get very angry when they have to get in touch with their feelings. And instead of realizing that Yoko's really good at getting them in touch with their feelings, they get really angry about having feelings in the first place. You know? So they take that out on Yoko, and they say, she's terrible, she made me feel all these horrible thoughts, which is just not true. She's really pretty amazing. She's always just talked about peace and communication and bringing people together, and she gets constantly attacked for that, which is just, you know, but so did Jesus and Gandhi and anybody who speaks about peace. They always attack those people.
What did you think of the documentary?
Which one? There's loads of documentaries.
The recent Beatles documentary.
Oh, the Beatles documentary? Well, that was fun. I mean, when I first started watching it, it was like so tedious. And I've spent time hanging out in studios with musicians, and it's a really slow, drawn-out process, one note at a time. How do you like this? How do you like this? And they have to play it for 3 minutes. No, no, let's try it a different way. You play it for another 3 minutes. No, let's try it another way. Try this beat. And it just goes on and on and on. But every 10 minutes in the Beatles documentary, there was a gem of a phrase, you know. And I mean, speaking of Yoko, it was really funny when Paul says, can you imagine if 50 years from now people were saying that the Beatles broke up because Yoko sat on an amp? And that's what people have been saying for 50 years. You know, it's just really... So to see Paul actually saying that, and the fact that they were aware of those kind of wrong ideas, it was fascinating. And also, especially since it went on for, you know, so long, what is it, 6 hours or something, and it's just so tedious. Then finally, when they hit the roof, it was an explosion. I mean, I'm not a person who dances much, and certainly I don't dance around my living room. But after watching that and sitting there for hours and hours and hours, all of a sudden it hit the roof. I was literally jumped up and started dancing around my living room.
Yeah.
It was that exciting. And I'm telling you, that's not something I've ever done before. But I found it really exciting and just, you know, a breath of fresh air to hear the Beatles playing music live and having fun. You know, it was great.
The camaraderie.
Right.
Yeah. You know.
Well, and also, yeah, to see them be such good friends, you know, I do wish we could have seen them talking George into coming back into the group, but there was no cameras around for that. But to see the different personalities and how they played out and how they interacted was fascinating. You know, so it was cool that they had the footage, and it was cool that they finally re-edited it to make a nice story out of it.
Well, just like your friend Henry Diltz, who hung around as friends with you know, various bands that he captured, all of these folks were your friends. They were part of your posse, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, some people became friends. Not all the people. I mean, some of the people I photographed once, and you know, I didn't become friends with James Brown, although I liked him, but he didn't. You know, we didn't get too close.
But James Brown was James Brown, so...
He was very cool. The first time I met him, actually, I was on assignment for Buddha Records, and they sent me to Washington, D.C. He was doing 3 days in a park somewhere, and I was supposed to take some pictures of him backstage, get some portraits, not just the live pictures on stage. And the first day, he was too busy, and I took great pictures of the show, and it was back in the days when he did the whole show, and the... You know, the band would run off stage and change suits and go from a pink suit to a blue suit in 30 seconds back on stage, still playing. At the end, he would, like, start to leave the stage, you know, five different times. He would fall to his knees, and they would put a cape on him, and he'd jump up and throw the cape off and come back to the microphone. Please, 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 me. I mean, he was just amazing. Amazing shows, but he didn't see me. He wouldn't pose for the pictures I needed for the record company. So the second day, again, he was too busy before the show, and I didn't get any time with him. The third day, I met him down in front of the hotel, and we're in the car going to the show, and I had wanted to do the pictures in the afternoon when it was daylight, and the show was starting in the evening, of course, so as we're driving, the sun is already going down, it's kind of twilight, it's getting a little dark, and I'm hoping I can get some pictures of him before it gets too dark. And he tells me to get in the limo in the front seat with him. So I'm between him and the driver in the front seat of a limo. And he decides to start telling me how to write a song. And I'm not really a journalist or a writer. Like, I didn't really care. And I'm not taking notes or anything. I'm there just to take pictures. And he's telling me that if you get a bass line going and then you change the bass line, you've changed the song. And every time you get a new bass line to go with a new drum line, you got a new song or something like that. I don't know. I'm not a musician. I wasn't taking notes, you know. But I just thought, like, okay, Mr. Brown, as soon as you're done, can we take some pictures, you know? And we finally get to the theater and get out of the car, and backstage he stands there and poses. And by that time, it was so dim. And he's a very dark, dark man. You know, the people have all kinds of different skin tones, and his was very dark. And in the dim light backstage, I didn't really get very good pictures. It was, I got good pictures of him on stage during the live show, but the portraits that he posed for, he was really dark and the light was really dim and it just didn't come out well. The next time I saw him, I again had an opportunity to do a photo session with him. He was a little more cooperative that time. I got some better pictures, but again, it was like so dark that I didn't get the exposures right. He was still too dark. The third time, we came out in front of the hotel on 5th Avenue and 59th Street. He was posing for me in the broad daylight and sunlight. That time, I got some really good pictures of him. But you need a lot of light to take pictures of James Brown, to have him come out well, anyway.
Trial and error, right?
He's a funny guy. Also, one time I did a video for him, my friend Vicky Wickham and Nona Hendrix, they were good friends with James Brown. Vicky Wickham was the producer for Ready Steady Go in England, and she was the first one to bring James Brown to England, as well as a lot of the other black American acts. Vicky's amazing. And she, somebody had passed away, and Vicky was organizing a memorial, and James Brown had agreed to tape a 30-second tribute to whoever that was that had passed away. And we were meeting him at the Plaza Hotel, and we got there, and I remember Vicky was, you know, very efficient and talked to the people, and we got a room to wait, and we had like a small ballroom where I set up some lights and a video camera, and we're waiting for Mr. Brown, and we're waiting for Mr. Brown, and we're still waiting for him a couple hours later, and we're still waiting for him. Like, the whole afternoon we're just sitting in this empty ballroom waiting for James Brown, and he finally comes sailing into the room, fully wide awake. I don't know what he was on, but he was wide awake and sat down on the chair we had set up, looked right in the camera, delivered a perfect message, got up and left. He wasn't in the room for more than a minute, and we made a 30-40 second video. But he just came in, sat down, boom, knocked it out, and left. It was perfect. I mean, he's a real professional. I'd see him again anytime.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Now, do you dream about some of these folks you've captured
in your
past?
I don't dream about anything, actually.
No.
No, I gave up dreaming a long time ago. I don't know. Maybe I just daydream too much. But no, I don't really, I probably do dream, but I rarely, rarely ever remember any kind of dream. But no, I don't live in the past. I mean, I had a lot of good times. Sometimes I, you know, remember a fun moment or so like that. But I try to live in the present and deal with all the things that are going on to keep you alive nowadays. And, you know, I look to the future. I hope for things. But I basically try to stay in the present. You know, all the things I've done, I've done. I don't really need to think about them. I'm thinking about what I could do, what I will do.
Well, you have a very special heart for social causes.
I try to be helpful.
You always have. Is there some you want to talk about that are important?
Well, there's a couple of charities here in New York that I support. The Food Bank, which not only helps people eat, but they teach them how to cook. You know, some organizations, it's a really good organization, God's Love We Deliver, which brings food to people who can't go and get it. But the Food Bank actually brings food to cook and teaches people how to cook and how to support themselves. And if you can't eat, you can't even go and start to look for a job or to talk to anybody, even to get help for welfare or anything. The basic thing is you have to eat it, you know, every day to have some energy to go and do the next thing. So I think the Food Bank's a great organization to help people survive. And another organization I like to support is called Her Justice, which is a large group, over 1,000 lawyers who provide pro bono free legal service for domestic violent victims who need orders of protection and orders of divorce and just need help getting away from an abusive partner. And legal advice, legal help is extremely expensive. And a lot of the people who need help don't have the beginnings, don't even have money to get away, much less hire a lawyer. So I think that Her Justice is a great organization helping people in dire straits get out of those straits and get back on their feet and have a decent life. So those are the two main organizations I support, but also people like the Tibet Fund and the Rainforest Foundation and lots of different organizations, whatever I can. Because nowadays my pictures can raise money for people. And, you know, whenever I heard of an organization raising money to help people, I always wanted to contribute. But rock and roll photography is a very low-budget operation. I don't really make the kind of money that advertising photographers or fashion photographers might make. So I never really had money to donate to organizations. But now that my pictures can encourage other people to donate, I donate pictures all the time.
And do what I can to help. Represented by Morrison Hotel Gallery?
Morrison Hotel Gallery is the main gallery I work with. I'm not exclusive with anybody, but they're the main gallery, and they do very well nationwide and internationally on the internet. They're very good.
So, Bob, in closing, is there anything that you haven't captured that you'd like to capture in terms of photo?
Well, not so much. What I try and capture, actually, is freedom. Because for me, rock and roll is about the freedom to express your feelings very loudly in public. And that's what I try to put in my pictures. I try to capture some feelings and not just facts. And I've done that a lot. And I like to show my pictures. I like people to see them. I like to capture that moment when everybody's screaming yay and nobody's thinking about paying the rent. And I like people to see my pictures and feel that moment. And feel free and feel some kind of openness and, you know, to relax a little into life. But as far as trying to take more pictures now, I don't need to do it. It's funny, last fall the new band Maneskin called me up out of the blue. I never heard of them, but they had heard of me. Apparently they grew up looking at my pictures and they wanted to meet me and have a photo session. It was the first thing they wanted to do when they came to New York. I was thrilled. They're the biggest band in the world right now. They are pretty amazing. I didn't know anything about them when they called me. I went to see their show, and I thought their show was very modern rock and roll, that they were communicating with their audience. They talked to their audience. They looked like they were having a good time. And when a band looks like they're having a good time, the audience will have a good time. And working with Måneskin was fun. They're a very nice group of people. And, you know, they're young and interesting and very talented. So that was fun. But I don't need to do that anymore. And I've written my book, so I have an autobiography that just came out last year. That was very exciting to finally get that done after wanting to do that for many years. I recorded an audio book for my biography if people want to go and listen to me tell the story instead of just reading it themselves. So, you know, I've accomplished a lot. I don't know. There's not a lot I want to do right now except perhaps place my archive in a good place so that people can have access to it and my pictures last for a long time and encourage and enlighten people. And I'm having a good time. I'm old enough to have grandchildren now. That's actually what I really enjoy, is seeing my grandchildren have a good time. Seeing my son be successful, that's what's really interesting to me nowadays. I really don't need to get on a bus with a bunch of 22-year-olds drinking beer. I did that with the Clash and with the Sex Pistols and with the New York Dolls, and it was a lot of fun. But at this point in my life, I don't need to do it again. You know, I remember trying to tell John Lennon, come down to CBGB's, it's lots of fun, there's all these bands and people drinking and having a good time. And he said, I did that in Hamburg. I don't need to go back. And now I understand very much what he means. You know, you get to a point in your life where you've done it, you don't need to do it again. You don't even need to keep doing it. At this point, I wouldn't want to go back to Max's and hang out with all of those people. Because it's, you know, we're all older. Things are different. Things change, you know. And I don't mind things changing. I'm really glad to be older. That's what happens, you know. Like Keith Richard, I'm glad to be here, but I'm glad to be anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
You were in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I was, and that's the name of my book, Right Place, Right Time, because, that just made things happen for me, but it's not just being in the right place at the right time. You have to then do the right thing and make that situation work for you and for whoever you're with. And I always found that if I could make it work for them, then that would work for me. So I always found that you can be in a situation better if you contribute to the situation, if you're part of the scene, not just visiting and observing and staring at people like they're weird. But if you're part of the scene, then you can, you know, get a much more intimate view of it.
Thanks for sharing the West Village with me.
All right, yeah, this is my little neighborhood here. It's nicer by the river here than up by the streets, but there is this highway that goes by and makes a lot of noise.
It's beautiful. Yeah. It's glorious. I'm so grateful for your generosity, Bob.
It's kind of day you're happy to be alive. Actually, I'm happy to be alive, whether it's raining or snowing or whatever.
There you go.
I like it all.
Thank you for taking a walk.
All right,
Bob.
Thank you.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.